Enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
I'm HRN's Executive Director, Katie Mosman-Wadler, with a preview of this week's episode of Meat and Three, HRN's weekly food news roundup. This week, we're celebrating Pride. We speak to the bakers who created a custom wedding cake for Charlie Craig and David Mullins, the couple behind the Masterpiece Cake Shop Supreme Court case.
We felt that what happened to Charlie and David was an absolute injustice.
Kat Johnson addresses the controversy surrounding Anthony Porosky, Queer Eye's food and wine expert.
Many viewers thought these recipes were unsophisticated.
And finally, Hannah Forden speaks with nutrition educator Leah Kurtz about the relationship between veganism and queer identity.
It's an interesting way in which food can challenge invisible value systems even greater than sexuality does.
Listen to Meat and Three, that's M-E-A-T plus sign T-H-R-E-E, this week, and celebrate Pride with HRN. Available on Stitcher, Apple Podcasts, and your favorite listening apps.
I'm Massimo Bottura.
Hi, this is Amanda Cohen.
This is David Kinch.
This is Mike Anthony.
This is Huni Kim.
This is Amanda Freitag.
This is Richard Blaze.
This is Paul Kahn.
This is Curtis Stein.
This is Stephen Harris.
This is Missy Robbins.
And you're listening to Andrew Talks to Chefs on Heritage Radio.
We got a New York Times review. We got a Michelin star. The Next Iron Chef premiered. You know, we call it like the week. You know, I got rising star chefs from star chefs. All this happened in 1 week. It was like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday,
Friday. Oh my God.
We've never looked back since that week. But since that week, we've also never stopped evolving.
That's Chef Mark Forgione on the early days of his restaurant, Mark Forgione, in New York City.
We could sit on our hands and, you know, serve the 15 dishes that everybody loves.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Restaurants that do that. And take the money and kill it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I just can't do it. You know, never mind me. I don't think we can do it as a restaurant. You
mm-hmm.
know, where we enjoy the change and the kind of crazy hecticness too much.
Well,
I
sounds like
once you stop evolving, I don't know. There's a weird stagnant thing. And like, maybe that's why we're about to be 10 years old.
All of that and much more on this week's episode of Andrew Talks to Chefs. It's gonna take a prolonged arrangement of the senses to make some sense of this. Hi, everybody. Welcome to the show. This is Andrew Talks to Chefs. I am your host, Andrew Friedman, here with
Caitlin Friedman.
Caitlin Friedman. Good morning, Caitlin.
Listen to this voice I have.
This is your morning voice.
This will tell you that we always record our intros in the middle of the night, because this is how I sound in the morning.
Yeah, this is we're sitting here on Tuesday morning, June 19th, and this is going to be a very short intro, everybody. We have had some, for various reasons, very involved intros the last few weeks. Obviously, we lost Tony Bourdain a couple of weeks ago, and I was upset about that New York Times review. We've spent a lot of time on things. I want to keep the focus squarely on our guest. And our guest this week is Chef Mark Forgione. A lot of people may know Mark from television. I don't think that's how he'd like to be primarily known. He'd primarily like to be known as a working chef. And I have to say, Caitlin, do you know what I hate more than, not more than anything, but do you know what I really hate?
No.
I hate what I refer to unaffectionately as legacies.
Oh, yeah, you do hate legacies.
I hate people who are sort of born. Gwyneth Paltrow would be an example.
Oh, man, you're slamming Gwyneth.
No, it's not even fair to her. I don't know Gwyneth Paltrow, but her father was Bruce Paltrow, the TV producer. Her mom was Blythe Danner. These are people. Legacy is a kind of a college term. You know, you get into a college because you were a legacy. So, Mark Forgione, Mark, if you're listening, don't be upset with me, because I think this is actually a nice way to introduce you. Mark technically would be considered probably a legacy. Mark is the son of Larry Forgione, who was the chef of American Place, and before that, River Cafe. He's an American culinary icon. But here's the thing. Mark is very much, and you'll hear about this in the interview, he's very much his own man. He's definitely, for anyone who's had his food, especially at his restaurant, Mark Forgione, he is his own chef. I mean, his food's great. And he put in, he paid his dues, and he worked his way up the kitchen line. And he, I don't want to give away how, but he went over to France and got his butt kicked the way, you know, some people do. And he actually suffered a little bit for being Larry's kid. And that's what we're going to hear, part of what we're going to hear about in this interview, which I really enjoyed. I've known Mark in passing for a long time, but we had never really sat down and had a heart-to-heart like this. So we met recently at his restaurant in Lower Manhattan, restaurant Mark Forgione. By the way, he says this in the interview, he can't stand that name. It was originally called Forge, which is kind of a nickname people in the family tend to take on. And there's a restaurant called The Forge on Miami Beach, where I grew up in Miami. It's about as far away as you could get from what Mark does, but they got like a cease and desist or something, and they had to change the name. So he named it Restaurant Mark Forgione. In any event, Mark worked early in his career for the chef Patricia Yeoh, who people may remember from Restaurant AZ. He then spent years working for Laurent Tourandel in various BLT restaurants before that whole thing kind of came apart and Laurent found himself out of there. Caitlin, you've eaten at Restaurant Mark Forgione.
I have. He's an excellent chef.
Well, I ate there very recently because I won a contest that Mark threw on Twitter. He put up a drawing of five chefs and asked first person who could name those chefs won a dinner for two at his restaurant. I was going to stay out of it, but because of the book I just wrote, I immediately recognized those chefs. But then Ming Tsai decided to try to win the dinner. He got four of the five chefs right. And I decided if Ming was going to do that, I was going to go ahead and get the dinner. So I won the dinner and went in with my friend Aaron Bluthorn, the chef of Cafe Blood, and the dinner was phenomenal. I loved our conversation, and I'm now going to ask everyone to imagine. I got to make this part of the thing shorter too, Caitlin. I keep doing these huge, long, like I'm trying to hypnotize people as I set up these scenarios. Like I listen back, and it's like, oh my God. So everybody, imagine it's a weekday morning, and you're in the dining room of Restaurant Mark Forgione. Mark and I are seated at one of the high tables in the bar, and we start our interview, and I hope you enjoy it. Here you go. I came into dinner for the first time in maybe 2 years, week and a half ago, 2 weeks ago. Well, I should say I won a contest.
Yep, you did.
I still feel guilty about that.
I think it's fair and square, man. You, well, like you said, you gave Ming a chance.
Once I saw Ming Tsai got in, I'll hopefully remember to explain all this in the intro. Once he came in and missed it by one, I thought I may as well grab it. But I hadn't been here in a while. I was really struck by the vibe in this restaurant. Do you have a pretty big base of regulars here?
Yeah, I mean,
it felt very kind of, I don't know what the analogy is. I don't want to compare it to like Cheers, but there was that everybody knows your name vibe.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. We're coming up on 10 years. June is 10 years.
It's amazing.
It's crazy.
How many of those years is Restaurant Mark Forgione?
I mean, it's always been the same restaurant. We just had to change the name.
Yeah, no, I meant the name change.
I think maybe we were Forge for a year.
Okay.
Maybe a year and a half.
Yeah.
I always explain to people that I never wanted to name the restaurant Mark Forgione. To this day.
I didn't know this. Was this like a...
I got sued by the
There
Forge.
Was like a cease and desist thing?
Yeah, yeah.
The Forge on Miami Beach?
Yeah.
Oh, my God. I grew up in Miami.
And he would never even talk to me. He wouldn't pick up the phone.
Just had the
he
lawyer
wouldn't
do
talk
it.
To me.
Oh, my God.
Yeah, I hate, to this day, I hate saying Restaurant Mark Forgione. I hate it. Like, it gives me the creeps.
Yeah.
But it is what it is.
It works.
To be honest, it kind of helped me personally. But the reason I'm bringing this up is that we just did a list to answer your question of how many regulars we have. You know, we're having a big party for the 10-year, and we're trying to make, like, an invitation list.
Yeah.
And I asked my office manager to put together a list of anybody that's eaten here more than 50 times.
Oh, my God.
And there's over 150 people that have eaten here over 50 times.
Oh, my God. That's got to be in some kind of very atmospheric
select group. That's crazy.
It's so, and it's funny.
But also, that should be flattering. I mean, first of all, there's so many restaurants in New York. Second of all, I mean, this isn't an exorbitant restaurant to come to, but this is, you know, it's not a cheap restaurant. Well, I'd feel pretty damn good if I were you.
Yeah, you know, we do. And especially being down here, I mean, you know, the great chefs that are down here, the great chefs that aren't here anymore. Yeah. I mean, you know, the restaurants that we've seen close. Yeah. I mean, it's like, it's just nuts, again, that we've been here a decade.
Yeah.
You know, we've made it through the recession, you know, from 2008 to 2010.
Yeah.
You know, the restaurants we've seen open and close, never mind close, but open and then close.
Yes.
In the time that we've been here.
You mean like relatively speaking neighbors?
Yeah. I mean, and chefs that I'm friends with and, you know, it's, and respect, and they're great chefs. And it just didn't work out. So the fact that we've figured out something down here.
Yeah.
You know, it's very humbling. I feel very blessed.
Yeah.
And we're very proud. You know, I think, you know, you can ask anybody that's in the know. You know, I mean, you just ate here. You know, I think sometimes the being Larry's son thing and, you know, the Iron Chef thing. And there's a lot of other fluff that goes around the place.
Yeah.
But the people that know this place know that you can come here and have a banging meal and have a great time. And, you know, we change the menu almost every day. And I don't want to say we're a secret because, you know, we're pretty popular nationally. But at the end of the day, I think what we really do behind closed doors is almost like one of the best kept secrets in New York.
Do you feel that way? I guess I think geography probably has a lot to do with that because you're kind of on the edge down here.
Yeah.
Both.
I can't tell you how many times.
You're on the southern fringe and you're on the western fringe.
And I can't tell you how many times, you know, I see chefs at events or people or even critics or food writers.
Yeah.
And I'm like, you know, you've never been to the restaurant.
Ever.
Yeah.
Oh, wow. I felt bad that it had just been a couple of years.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that was my third dinner here.
Yeah.
And I think I'd been to one after party for some, maybe a City Meals after party here.
Yep.
So you brought it up. Can we get this out? I feel like I have to get it out of the way because you didn't make the decision to be Larry Forgione's son. I know you're proud of it. But what was it like for you coming to the decision to go into this profession? Was it always, were you always going to do that?
No, not at all, actually.
Was it the opposite of that?
It was completely the opposite. It wasn't... you know, I think some people might, and I try to explain this in my book. You know, it wasn't like I was like, my dad pulled me aside at 7 years old and said, okay, you know, this is caviar and this is foie gras. This is how you make a roux. And, you know, I had a toque on in the, it couldn't have been farther from that. I mean, you know, we ate great and, you know, there was fresh foods and we went to farms and, you know, we would meet fishmongers, but I kind of just thought that was a normal part of life.
Yeah.
And to be honest, it was a normal part of life, you know, before I think things got a little messed up in the 70s and 80s with, you know, fast food and, so I always had,
you mean that people would go to
farmers markets,
fishmongers,
you know, all that
well,
kind of
especially
stuff.
A family of your back, you know, especially the Italian side of your family, like
it was normal.
That was part of the culture.
My dad
certainly
grew up on his grandma's farm.
Yep.
And,
yep.
You know, my mother had a garden and, you know, like I said, we would go to Long Island farms and I would go with my dad to like meet this guy who raised ducks. Like, so it wasn't, maybe it was osmosis, but I didn't really think anything about it. It was just normal. And then I'd go to other people's houses and, you know, you know, they'd open like a can of something and I'd be like, what in God's name?
Yeah.
Like, this is gross.
Right.
Like, but wasn't being judgy. I was just like, ew, this isn't what green beans taste like in my house. Like, anywho, so, you know, when it came time, I was a teenager and, you know, to make some money, I needed money. I wanted a job, you know.
Yeah.
My dad had restaurants, just like if your dad was, you know, he owned a grocery store, he'd probably bag groceries. My dad was a chef. So I went into the restaurant and, you know, I cleaned vegetables. I was a prep guy and, you know, helped do dishes for a little while. I was even a host at one point in the front of the house.
How'd you like that?
I hated it. I hated wearing a suit. I hated putting like gel in my hair. I just hated the whole
small talk.
Not me.
Yeah.
I'm a back of the house guy. I always have been.
Yeah.
But anyway, so, you know, those were like my summer jobs.
Yeah.
And even then I didn't realize the gravity or the scope of how great and influential my dad's restaurants were. It was just dad's restaurant.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah, totally.
And then as I just got older, I started to realize, like, holy shit, like, whoa, like, this is serious stuff. Like,
yeah.
People coming up to me like, you don't understand, your dad. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
But then I went to college, and it was not to be a chef.
What did you think you were going to do?
I had no idea. I really had no idea. You know, I, in a weird way, I kind of got intrigued by like FBI profiling and like, so I thought there was something in psychology maybe for me.
Okay.
You know, to this day, you know, I'm still intrigued. I want to know why some people are psycho.
What makes people tick?
Yeah. Why psycho in particular?
Oh, you mean that in particular?
Like, why, what, you know, because if you do research on a lot of the psychos, there's no like set pattern, you know, some of them are abused, some of them weren't, some of them are small town, some of them aren't. I mean, there's like, you know, there's no real thing.
Yeah.
Anyway.
Did you actually make a, like you, did you study this kind of thing?
When I
you,
went.
You, did you read books on this? And
to say I studied it is a stretch. I've read some books, you know what I mean?
You dabbled.
And then I majored in psychology my freshman year.
Okay.
And I don't know. I just thought the class was so boring. I hated it.
Right.
You know? Like I was never a books guy.
Yeah.
I could do it when I wanted to, but.
Right.
Anyway, so then I really wasn't vibing school. Went to California with my buddy. And then when I came back, you know, I started working again. And I worked for like a year and a half at that time. I split between an American place, and at the time there was a new restaurant that my dad started called The Grill Room, which was right down here.
Mm-hmm.
And that was kind of when I think I started to like really fall in love with not just the cooking, but the whole vibe of the restaurant scene.
Mm-hmm.
Like I was like, God damn, like, you know, if you read like Anthony Bourdain's books, like, you know, the first one, Kitchen Confidential, like, you know, it wasn't so much like just falling in love with cooking. It was like the whole
life
thing of it. Like, you know what I mean? Like, I love these guys I was hanging out with. There was this one guy from England, you know what I mean? There was this other guy from the Bronx, you know what I mean? There was just like all these like different people. There was the, you know, beautiful girl from, you know, New Jersey who had like spiked hair and like tattoos. And I was just like, holy, you know, I was a 19-year-old kid and I was just like, this is like incredible. Like, this is so much fun. And we grab a drink after work. And, you know, that was, the, you know, that was to me like the first, I think, taste of the whole thing.
Yeah.
But then I ended up going back to school and then I majored in hotel and restaurant management.
Mm-hmm.
Which, to be honest, wasn't really challenging, but I graduated with a degree in hotel restaurant management.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then I think the trip after college really kind of changed my life. I backpacked through Europe with five of my buddies. And
for how long?
It was like 11 weeks.
Mm.
And this was before the Euro, so it was like, you know, you'd get to certain countries and you could have a meal for like $20.
Yeah.
Drinking, you know, wine and like appetizers and entrees and dessert and like, you know. Like, you know, Prague in particular. Like,
right. So you're just like backpacking, your rail pass,
staying in hostels that, you know, sleeping on the beach sometimes.
It's amazing.
It was incredible. And I think that it should be part of every single American's criteria of life. Like, you should have to do that. It changes everything, at least for me. Anywho, so, you know, I just got to see like all this different culture. And
yeah.
I don't have to tell you, you know, the way that they eat and the way that they, you know, I stayed on a farm where they make olive oil.
Yeah.
And, like, you know, it was just amazing to watch people sit down. Like, I'm getting goosebumps, like, just to sit down and, like, eat and the way that they did this thing. And it was like breakfast and the siesta and
yeah.
It was just crazy.
Like, yeah.
It just kind of sparked something in me. And I came back, and this was not by choice. I'll never forget it. I took an early flight home, then my buddies to get to my grandfather's birthday, got there. And then my dad said, look, somebody just quit. I need you to cover somebody's shift tomorrow.
Mm. Which restaurant?
An American place.
Uh-huh.
I literally didn't even unpack my bag from this 11-week trip. And I woke up the next morning, got on the train, you know, went to Manhattan from Long Island. And that was 2001.
Okay.
And I never stopped.
Wow.
Like, that was it. I never stopped.
And what role was that in the kitchen that you were jumping into?
I was just covering hot apps.
Okay.
You know what I mean? Like, somebody quit, you know, whatever.
Yeah, you were doing work in a station.
And then, but there was never this conscious decision of, oh my God, I'm going to be a chef. I think the moment that I had that aha moment, so I probably did like 2.5 years of like the New York City line cook.
Yeah.
You know, left my dad, went to work with Patricia Yeoh.
Yes.
I did AZ and Pazzo, opened Pazzo.
Yeah.
you know, that was how I met Laurent, because Laurent Tourneau took over Patricia's restaurants because he partnered with Jimmy. I ended up staying on.
Now, for people who don't know, Patricia Yeoh had a restaurant. She had been a sous chef to Bobby Flay, if I'm not mistaken. Yep. And then she opened a place called AZ. Jimmy, who you just referred to as the, I guess, the money guy, Jimmy Haber.
Yep.
And AZ was a great restaurant. It was, God, were people still using the word fusion back then? Maybe.
I guess. I mean, you know,
it was like modern Asian.
It was like Asian-Italian fusion.
It was a three-star New York Times restaurant at a time when that was still fairly rare.
Caused a lot of ruckus when she got the three stars.
Yeah. And I remember very vividly bringing Alfred Portale there, which I rarely stuck my neck out and brought Alfred to a restaurant on my recommendation. But I had been there right when it opened, and I remember being kind of knocked out by it.
Yeah.
That was a really good restaurant.
In their heyday, in their prime.
Yeah.
And I thought Pazzo was great too.
Yep.
We opened it. And then
Haber partnered with Laurent Tourneau, who you just mentioned, and that was the ill-fated BLT partnership.
Yep. I mean, there's so much drama and history there. I mean, the reason that Laurent took over was because Jimmy and Patricia got into a fight. I get to basically watch AZ close.
Yes.
I mean, slowly, but close. Yeah. My friend and I, Christian Lomas, kind of like were there till the dog days. And then Keith Haber, who ended up splitting with Laurent also. Not Keith Haber, Keith Trabel.
Yeah.
He recommended to Laurent that he keep me.
Okay. Became BLT Fish.
I was the only... Yeah, but we opened Steak first.
Yeah.
Pazzo became Steak.
Yes.
And again, you know, you talk about life and ripples and who knows, like if Keith didn't recommend that Laurent keep me, because everybody else left. Clean, snip.
Yeah.
And for some reason, Keith said, you know, keep them, whatever. And then I got to spend like 6 weeks with Laurent Tourneau, just me and him.
Really?
And he
was getting ready to open Steak.
Yeah, in an empty kitchen.
Mm.
Just him and I.
So for people who don't know, the very first BLT restaurant was BLT Steak. It was on 57th near Lexington. Yeah. And I think that's the first time I ever met you was I was writing Go Fish with him at that time.
Probably,
And came in one day.
Long time
Fred
ago.
Dexheimer was doing the wines.
Freddie Dexheimer.
Yep. So anyway, but that restaurant was one of the modern, this whole modern steakhouse thing where chefs jumped into the steakhouse world.
And this was also my first experience with a French chef.
Oh, really?
So this-
That's interesting. Oh, and, that's kind of, yeah.
You know, up until that point, you know, I had worked with Kazuto from Chinois, Maine, which is an amazing, I skipped over that part. It was an amazing experience. I did a summer at this place called Above.
That was the place your dad consulted to.
Yep.
Where was that? Times Square?
Times Square, yeah. It was such a weird location and a weird restaurant.
I ate there.
But the food was good.
Yeah.
I mean, it was so cool to have this. He was such a, I mean, you've met him. He's such a zen type person.
Again, for people who are listening, Kazuto Matsusaka.
And his wife, Vicky.
And his wife, Vicky. Kazuto was there was an original chef at Chinois in Maine, which was Wolfgang and Barbara Lazaroff's second restaurant. The original chef was Richard Krause. He left. Kazuto became the chef there. Brilliantly talented guy. And then your dad brought him to New York back when.
Yeah. I mean, this was
90s?
Circa 1998.
Late 90s? Yeah.
98, give or take.
Brought him into this restaurant called Restaurant Above, which it was named that because it had these incredible views of the city. Yeah.
Okay. So I had that stint.
Say Laurent was the first French chef you worked with, why do you point that out? Was that a cultural adjustment for you?
I was just about to get into that. So I had worked with American chefs. I had worked with, you know, Patricia. I had worked with Kazuto. I was kind of raised Italian.
Yeah.
So I kind of had like the Italian pedigree, but I'd never really truly worked with a French chef at this point.
Yeah.
And, you know, at this point, I'd been cooking on and off full time for almost 4 years.
Mm.
And to be able to spend this one-on-one time with Laurent, who I think is one of the most talented chefs of our era.
Unbelievably talented. Yeah.
Of our era.
Versatile. To me, one of the things about him is his versatility.
And that has rubbed off on
that
me, which we'll get to later, I think.
I mean, I think you could literally say to Laurent, I want to open an Indian restaurant in 2 weeks. Go get a menu, and he would just go hit the books, try stuff, and he'd come in with an amazing menu.
Yeah.
Like literally,
Okay. And that's what I love about him.
But anyway,
I am with this amazing French chef who was just coming off of Cello, which was arguably the best fish restaurant in New York City. And, you know, he's kind of asking me for advice on how do you make American barbecue sauce? You know, how do you make, what is it about steak sauce that Americans like? Like, what is this... You know, this whole obsession with, you know, whatever it is, the wedge salad. You know what I mean? It was just, and you know, Laurent, he was very legitimately very curious.
Yeah.
You know, and I think he knew because of who my dad was that I might be able to help him with answers to these questions about American cooking and, you know, whatever. So I spent this time with him. But I think this kind of sparked an interest for me to go to France.
Mm.
And I had already been toying with the idea of going to Europe. I just didn't know where I wanted to go yet. And I get the letter back from Michel Gérard while we're prepping to open BLT Steak that I got accepted to go there.
Yeah.
And, you know, I told Laurent, I don't think he was thrilled that I was opening and leaving, but he was also, I think, happy for me because I was kind of like a little cocky American kid at the time, you know, a little punk. I'll call myself a punk. And, you know, he was like, you know what? I think this is going to be good for you because they're going to beat you up.
Did he tell you that?
Yeah. And, you know, the reason that I wanted to go to Europe was because everywhere I went, I was Larry Fo Jones' kid.
Yeah.
You know, which is fine. I mean, I, you know, I'm not, you have to take that with the territory. And, you know, some people can cry about it. Like, yes, I am. You know, I would mess up. You know, oh, is that how your father showed you? What if your father tasted that?
Did people say that to you in kitchens? Oh, yeah. that must have sucked.
Oh, yeah. But again, it also made me stronger. And trust me when I tell you, no matter who I worked for, there was no, like, we'll call it hiding or taking a shift off. Or,
yeah.
I mean, it was always, the chef was ragging me and you know, pushing me. And not even just the chefs, but the sous chefs. I mean, think about the sous chefs. Like, oh, this is Larry Fo Jones' kid? Like, fuck him. You know what I mean? Like, So I wanted to go to Europe to get away from that and just, like, just be another cook.
Mm-hmm.
And trust me when I tell you, when I got there, they didn't care that,
they probably, I mean, no disrespect to your father. They probably had no idea who he was.
They didn't even know.
He had worked, we should say, he did work.
He worked with him.
Gerard. But the people who worked for him, I'm sure, had no idea.
I was just about to say, they didn't make that public knowledge. It was
It
was more, you know, like, you know, we'll take him in. Like, we'll, but it was like, you know, accepting a kid into the army. Like, they didn't, there was no special treatment whatsoever.
I'm sure.
And they, believe it or not, back then, I think this was really, you have to think about it. This was like pre, you know, there was internet, but this was pre everybody online all the time days.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't really even know who Danielle Boulud was or Thomas Keller was or, like, trust me, they didn't know who American chefs were.
In the late 90s, I was going to go to France. And I remember asking a couple of, I don't want to say who, but a couple of fairly, really famous American chefs if they could set me up over there. With reservations, and they just started laughing.
Yeah.
They're like, you think they know who I am?
Yeah, it's
and
crazy.
I'm talking like major, like legendary people.
Yeah.
You know, they're like, I have no pull over there like, and this whatsoever.
This was also pre, like this was just when El Bulli was just like, just people starting to whisper and talk about
it. Right, so France was still
France
it.
Was still
it, the pinnacle.
And trust me when I tell you, it was an island to its own.
Yes.
They are the best.
Yes.
Not even a question.
Yes.
Everybody else is okay.
Yep.
But we are the best.
Yes.
Trust me. When I was there, and this was also when Chirac and Bush were fighting too, so it was like perfect timing for an American to go over there. But anyway.
Did you speak French?
I didn't when I got there, but when I left, I actually couldn't speak English when I got home.
Uh-huh.
Because it was a tiny village. 400 people lived in this village.
Amazing. How long were you there?
A little over a year.
Yeah.
And I started, at peeling potatoes and carrots, and it was crazy.
Is that what you expected going over?
I didn't know what I was expecting, to be honest. But when I got there, I couldn't communicate with anybody, so there really wasn't any choice. It was like, go in the basement. But the chef de partie of banquets, essentially.
Yeah.
You know, they watch the way you peel a carrot. They watch how fast you move. They watch how clean you keep your station.
Yeah.
And then, you know, eventually, by the time I left, I was working the fish station, which was huge. They hadn't had an American work the line, according to them. And I don't know, they said like something like 14 years. So
amazing.
I learned so much, but that was when I had my aha moment.
Which was what?
I was by myself. You have to remember, the first 4 months, I couldn't talk to anybody.
Yeah.
So I was by myself.
No other American staging.
They don't do Americans. Like I said, I'm sure that my dad helped.
Was it all French? Were there Japanese guys?
There were some Brazilians there. There were some Japanese guys there. There was two guys from Spain there.
Wow.
So I could kind of communicate with the guys from Spain because of my broken kitchen Spanish from New York. But yeah,
that was it.
I mean, dude, I was going to like sit in people's rooms and we were communicating through charades.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it was crazy.
Mm-hmm.
But I had a lot of alone time and like just in my book and like in my own head. And
when you say in your book, you mean you kept a journal?
Yeah.
Okay.
And it was, I just think in that moment, I was like, you know what? Like, you know, and also too, watching the culture of the way these guys cook.
Yeah.
Everybody lives in the village. I mean, yeah, you might go to somebody's house after work and have some wine or beer or whatever, but there wasn't like this, you know, New York, when you're 21 years old, you know, you get your ass kicked. You do 200 covers.
Yeah.
You go out, you drink the pain away, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
You wake back up, you do it all over again.
Yeah.
There, it was like, you worked for 14 hours, but you only did like 35 covers.
Yeah.
But every single thing was meticulous and done the right way and done a certain way. And then you all sat down together. You ate family meal together. You took an hour off. You came back. Everybody looked at it. I mean, it's just like such a different...
Yeah.
To this day, it's like I've never... experience anything like that.
Yeah.
You know, here it's...
Yeah.
Let's go. Let's go.
Yeah,
let's
yeah,
go.
Yeah,
let's
yeah,
go.
Yeah.
So, again, that was just when I fell in love, I think. I think that's the best way to describe it. Fell in love with cooking and food and experience and the life and the thing. And it was just like, wow.
Yeah.
And then I came back and, you know, went back with BLT, corporate chef for BLT, blah, blah, blah. And then I think opening BLT Market was the one that kind of reminded me about, because it was steakhouse after steakhouse after steakhouse and, you know, BLT Fish and then BLT Prime. And then we did BLT Steak in Dallas and BLT Steak. There was, you know, it was like a lot of steak and a lot of steakhouse a la carte. Even fish was, it was kind of a la carte. There were composed dishes. But BLT Market, I think, kind of reminded me of what I wanted to do.
Which was what?
To do a real farm to table, you know, purveyors and small plates and, you know, garnishes on the plate. And, you know, you have to remember, BLT Steak, I was doing the steak and a side dish.
Yeah.
Which, you know, and they were delicious, don't get me wrong, but...
It's great.
I just, BLT Market, it just came back to, you know, making a dish and was like, oh my God, you know what, I really miss this. And, you know, I gave Laurent notice and, you know, again, people don't, again, just don't realize because of my name and everything and I am chef and they think all this like just happened. But, you know, I shook the guy's hand right there. His name is Uwe. And I shook his hand and we had to give him $350,000 in 3 weeks. And we had $0.
For this space.
That was, well, that was the first payment.
Yeah.
And we had zero. I mean, not like we had potential money either. We had zero. It was just like, look, let's shake on it because I fell in love with this space.
Mm. What was here before?
It didn't look like this at all. It was called the Deck.
Okay.
There was no brick.
There
was no bar. I mean, we changed the whole thing. But I saw it. Like as soon as I walked through the front doors, it was almost like the place gave me a hug.
You knew what you were going to do.
Yeah.
It's so amazing when that happens.
Yeah, it was. There was not a doubt. Like, it was not a doubt.
Do you have a background with any of that, like design or like how do you?
I had the vision of what I wanted my restaurant to look like. Like not to like freak you out or anything, but like my family has the visions or whatever. Like we all have a little bit of psychic ability.
It's like
kind of passed down. And I like had this vision and I swear to you when I walked through the door, it was like, this is it. This is the space.
Almost like it had been foretold.
If I showed you my journal, which I don't have here, but if I showed you my journal when I was like writing what I want my first restaurant to look like,
you had a sketch of something of this.
You have no idea. I mean,
now what do you mean? Well, can we go back to what you just said? Your family. This is a ability that your family.
Have you ever heard of Padre Pio?
No.
So after this, look, do a little research on Padre Pio.
But okay.
Padre Pio's real name is Francesco Forgione.
Okay.
And he had like the gift of tongues, and you know he could like give three different sermons at the same time in different places.
Uh-huh.
It was tortured by visions and, you know, we all have this.
And this is a ancestor of yours.
Yeah, we all have this weird kind of thing. And it's not a bad thing. It's like,
yeah, but you've been told this since you were a kid.
Yeah. I mean,
you guys all talk about this.
Yeah. It's okay. Like a thing.
How, when you describe that, how powerful a thing is that? Like,
it depends how much you focus on it.
Okay.
You know what I mean?
Like you can go deep on it if you want.
If you want. You know, like, for example, like if I went and sat on a mountain for, you know, 3 weeks and, yeah, like, you know, meditated, like, which we do every once in a while, but, you know, especially in New York City, it kind of gets a little incubated.
Yeah.
You know?
Okay. So when you walked in here, you knew.
I just knew it. It was an energy, a feeling, a thing.
Is that the same thing that gave you the confidence to shake hands, not having like any of that money lined up?
In
you
a
just
kind of knew
like I knew it was going to come together.
Yeah.
Okay.
Don't get me wrong. I was scared shitless.
Okay.
And then we just started to have dinner parties at people's apartments. We'd ask people to bring their checkbooks, and I cooked every night for like 2.5 weeks in somebody's different apartment. And buying the ingredients at the grocery store. And
people came in as limited partners.
We'd do like a six top at somebody's apartment. And then somebody at that dinner would say, I've got like 5 more people. What do you say we do it? Yeah, and we raised the first 350. And then, okay, now we have another month to raise the next 350.
It's amazing.
I mean, trust me when I tell you, and I try to explain this to everybody, like this was not a situation where it was like, I have 31 investors.
Mm-hmm.
It was not a situation where somebody was like, oh, you want to open a restaurant? No problem.
Kid, you didn't have what some people would call a whale.
Oh, no. Still don't. Like a four-leaf clover, shining like a tiny bride, landing on all four feet like a cat who's ready for a wild night. My theme song and break music is from After School Specials album, Double Barrel, Single Entendre, which is available on iTunes.
Think about what it takes to swim a coastline longer than the entire eastern seaboard and leap tall waterfalls in a single bound. What does it take to survive 200 feet deep in icy salt water? What would you be made of? Wild Alaska Seafood is made of tight muscle mass, long chain omega-3s, and incredible micronutrients. It matters where your food comes from. Experience the flavor of the fittest in every bite and enjoy food the way nature intended. Alaska Seafood, wild, natural, and sustainable. Ask for Alaska on the menu, grocery store, or smart device. For more information, visit wildalaskaseafood.com.
Welcome back to the show. We're going to get you to the rest of our interview with Chef Mark Forgione in just a moment. But Caitlin, first of all, how about that part where Mark talks about his family's psychic abilities?
Yeah, I love that part.
I have always said this. I'm at best an agnostic. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in any kind of organized religion. But given the fact that we're all here... and that this planet is here and life exists, I don't rule anything else out.
Well, no, and you know my mother was really deep into all this stuff.
That's true. Your late mother was into that and did readings and all kinds of stuff. Also, because Mark instructed me to, I did look up Padre Pio online. And the drawings of Padre Pio look just like Mark's father, Larry. There's a strong resemblance.
See, that's weird and awesome.
Yeah. Also, I need to find out how that tuna porterhouse that Mark talked about in the interview came out.
That sounded so good.
I know. That's like my dream dish. I have to go get that next time it's on the menu there. Anyway, listen, guys, like I said, we're keeping it short this week. Just as always, a reminder to please subscribe to this show on Stitcher or iTunes. It is easily the best way to keep up on the show. It'll just drop into your feed every week. Or you can follow the show. The handle is at Chef Podcast. That's best done on Instagram, but you can also follow us on Facebook or Twitter, although I think I'm going to get rid of the Twitter account soon. I keep saying I'm going to do that. And if you would leave a review or a rating for us on Apple's iTunes Store, that helps people find the show, and we would appreciate that. And Mark does allude to this in the interview, so I'll keep this short as well. Just a reminder that my book, Chefs, Drugs, and Rock and Roll, about the American chef movement of the 70s and 80s, is available any way you'd like to read it, hardcover, digitally, or as an audiobook. So please check that out if you haven't already. And with that, I'm going to return you to the rest of our interview with Chef Mark Forgione. I hope you enjoy it. Here's what's striking to me about this restaurant, right, is... It's a very, I mean, I don't know how you would describe it. This room is very comfortable. It doesn't feel like something that was just built or designed 10 years ago.
No, now it feels like
home. It feels like very classic. It feels like in the best way, like it just kind of sprung up here, right?
Well, the funny thing is this is all original stuff.
You're pointing at all the brickwork around the room.
We didn't do much.
How about the shelving? The opposite wall has wood shelves.
It's funny about the shelves. When we built the shelves,
yeah,
we had no plan of what to put in the shelves.
Oh, really? You didn't know if it was going to be books, knickknacks. It's a little bit of everything now.
Well, now it's the way that it started is I think it was like the fourth night we were open. This woman said, well, what are you going to put in the shelves? And we were like, I don't know.
Oh, they were just bare?
Nothing in them.
Yeah.
We were like, I don't know. And the next day we got I'll show you after the thing, but an antique sausage stuffer.
Oh, cool.
And she was like, put this in the shelf.
Okay.
And then this natural thing just started to happen.
People started
giving us gifts. And
great.
Then, you know, we started to put awards and whatever. It's just like now we get stuff, we put it in the thing. Like I have something in my bag today because some guy gave me a sticker from an event that I did like 2 weeks ago that I forgot about. And I found it in my closet and I was like, you know what? I'll put that in the shelf.
Yeah. So how do you define what you do here? The food seems to me to be so distinctive here. But in a way that I'd be hard pressed to like really put like a catchphrase to.
Yeah, I mean,
do you just think of it as your food?
I was just going back to kind of what I said before about how we talked about how Laurent, like, you know, he was so open to kind of anything.
Yeah.
And not just Laurent too, my dad too. If you go back at it, like, you know, my dad was doing like some Asian stuff, like, mm-hmm. you know, way back then. I mean, you know, it's like the way that I look at, and I never really sat down and said, okay, this is what I'm going to do. But the way that I look at what American food is now,
yes.
you know, as I'm reading your book, like going back to all these guys,
yeah.
I don't think they really had an idea either.
No, zero. That's what Jonathan Waxman, where we made it up. You know, he said to me once in an interview, he just stopped me in the middle of a question and goes, you know, we were just making this up as we went, right?
Right. And that's
because I was about to ask some deep question and he was like, there was no plan.
And that's kind of how I feel about here is, you know, when you say American, I mean, you know, never mind American. We want to take it to the next level. Like when we talk about New York City, like New York City is the biggest melting pot in the world.
Mm.
You know, we just went through the different types of people that I worked for.
Yeah.
So for me not to just kind of cook, with as much liberty as I possibly feel, it was like, it'd almost be unjust to the people that I worked for. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you can ask any of my chefs, like, we make stuff, we have ideas, you know, going back to the vision thing, I have weird visions of
food,
of dish all the time.
And you dream dishes?
Dream, like I said, I'll just see something. If I think my chef Andy is here, like you can even ask him off.
Yeah, I saw him walk
after.
In.
You can just say, hey, you know, the chef text you text message you guys about ideas and he'll show you his phone. And it's like,
What'll it be? Will it be shorthand? Will it just be like three ingredients or will it be
like I'll just be sitting there. For example, yesterday.
Yeah.
I was sitting in the backyard. I was actually reading your book. And I don't know why it came to me, but I was like, you know what would be cool if you cut a tuna in the shape of a porterhouse and we did like a tuna porterhouse for two. Like you never really, fish for two is always a whole fish. Like let's do a big, thick, like 12 ounce tuna steak.
And it comes out like carved. And
yeah, and we're going to do a bone marrow with caviar on it. Awesome. And we're going to do sides like you're in a steakhouse, but it's with tuna. Again, I don't
know. That's great.
I don't know where or why or what that jumped in.
Is that going to happen?
We're serving it tonight. But maybe it was something that I read in your book. I don't know what it was. But my point is now that dish kind of to me sounds American, right?
Yeah.
So maybe tomorrow I might say, you know, God knows, but you know, let's go get those beautiful scallops from Alex and let's clean them, put them back in the shell, pour some dashi in it, seal the shell, and bake it. And when it opens, we'll sprinkle some seaweed salt on it.
Mm-hmm.
And that sounds kind of Japanese, right? You know what I mean? But it's like, we don't really have rules here. It's like,
but it's interesting to me that you said New York. Do you think of the food you do as New York food?
Through and through.
Really, you know, what's interesting to me is I just spent some time interviewing Tim Hollingsworth in LA, who has OTM Restaurant. And I asked him how he thought about what he did there. And he said for him, that was an amalgamation of all the stuff that's in Los Angeles, right? Which is, when he said it, I'm like, that's so obvious.
Yeah.
Like, I wouldn't have said that about what you do, but once you said it, it makes total sense to me.
I mean, New York is the biggest melting pot.
I know.
In
we
the
all
world.
Take it for granted here, but
in the world. Yeah. You know, I mean, like when you eat here, you start with an everything bagel.
Right.
With vegetable cream cheese, you know what I mean? But then you might have a play on chili crab.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? And then you might get, you know, a fish with, you know, glazed morels and white asparagus.
Totally.
And then you might finish with, you know, a French pastry for dessert. Like,
yes.
It's like, you know, and I don't look at it as fusion. Not that there's anything wrong with people that do fusion. I just, I don't look at it that way. I look at it as whatever ideas are exciting and, you know, and it's not just me. I let these guys try and get as creative as they can. I just, you know, as long as I taste it, we're good.
Did you start to think, it's interesting because you mentioned going overseas, right? And that being kind of an epiphany for you. But I wonder if that also gave you the ability to think about New York. There's nothing like perspective, right? Like to go away from home for a while, you see it differently.
Absolutely.
I almost wonder if that's part of what you got from spending a year away, was the ability to sort of appreciate what makes this city so unique. As somebody who grew up around here.
Yep. It's funny. You know it as well as I do.
It's easy to take it for... I was born here. I was gone from age 2 to 17. And then I came back at 17. I never left. So I've been here I've been here 33 years.
Yeah, we did almost the exact same thing. Yeah.
You know? But going away from it even briefly, I remember I used to... I didn't do really well in school my first year here. My punishment was I had to go back to Florida for the summer. It was like, instead of go to your room, it was like, get out of New York, you have to be in Florida. But this is how much I miss New York. I literally had dreams. Like, I'd have a dream I was on the one train. That was the dream. Yeah. Nothing happened.
I just
miss being here. Yeah, it's like people who have smoking dreams, you know?
Well,
people who quit smoking and then you have a dream that you have.
New York is like a love-hate relationship.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Like, I tell people all the time, I feel like part of me just wants to live in like a cottage in the woods and like, you know, like do all the stuff, you know, but you know, then there's the other part of me that, you know, when I leave New York, like there's just something about it. There's an energy, you know, that I think I first tasted when I was like probably 17 or 18. And like, I just remember like getting out of the train and coming out of Penn Station and like, you know, kind of similar to like when I walked in the front door here, like there's just this like, whoa.
Yeah.
Like I remember saying to my best friend at the time, like, dude, I, you know, we got to get an apartment in the city. Like, this is crazy.
You grew up where, Long Island?
Yeah. I was born, same as you. I was born here.
Yeah.
Moved to Long Island, I think, when I was 2 or 3.
Okay.
And then moved back here when I was, you know, whatever it is, 19.
Yeah. There is nothing like coming off the, if you really love New York. I mean, we moved to Hastings on Hudson, which is in Westchester. So we're just north of the city. I don't like not living in the city, but the one thing I love is when I come into Grand Central and you get off the train and you're in the city, that moment is almost worth it to me. Yeah. I love that moment. Yeah. It's like an appreciation. I don't know what you call it. It's like a jump starter for your appreciation. Yeah. You know, if you take it for granted. And how has this evolved over the years, what you do here?
You know, it's
from
funny.
What it was originally.
If I have any regrets about what we did here, is I don't think we opened the right way.
Yeah.
Didn't have enough cooks because we couldn't afford it. You know, we didn't have the right ingredients because we couldn't afford it. We didn't have the right, it's almost like one of those.
Was it the classic thing like, I want to have a restaurant.
Yes.
And then you did it.
We were serving food on like, I'm not joking, we bought plates secondhand from somewhere. And you know, my payroll, you know, was only a certain amount of things. So, like, we didn't have a butcher. You know what I mean? It was just like, you know, I think I was also living in that old French, what I saw in France. And I was like, oh, yeah, everybody will just do it themselves. Everybody comes in at 9 and leaves at midnight. Like, it's just not realistic in New York. It's just not.
Yeah.
And, you know, we didn't get great reviews in the beginning. And to be honest, looking back, I don't necessarily think we deserve them.
Mm.
I think if you go back and you read Sam Sifton's review, people don't realize we didn't get reviewed until 2 years from the New York Times, which I think was probably a blessing in disguise. But Sam Sifton came in and he loved it. I think we just started to hit our stride about 2 years into it.
Okay.
And you know as well as I do, the first 6 months, everybody comes in and checks it out.
Yeah.
And I don't think we like hit that fire with everybody. It wasn't like this the best new restaurant in New York.
Yeah, yeah.
And again, I don't think we deserve to be. So in a weird way, it let us grow up, which not a lot of restaurants get that to happen. We just, we stuck to it. But since you know, since that week or whatever it was, you know, we got a New York Times review, we got a Michelin star, the Next Iron Chef premiered, you know, we call it like the week. You know, I got rising star chefs from star chefs. All this happened in 1 week. It was like Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, Friday.
Oh my God.
And, you know, we've never looked back since that week. But since that week, we've also never stopped evolving.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the way that I look at this place is like, you know, I'm always buying new plates. We're always meeting a new purveyor. We're always changing something that we serve. We're always thinking about a new thing to put on the table. We're always, you know what I mean? There's just always something. Trust me, you know, you can pull my managers aside and they'll tell you, like, you know, sometimes it's exhausting. But, you know, we could sit on our hands and, you know, serve the 15 dishes that everybody loves.
Yeah.
And there's nothing wrong with that. Restaurants that do that. And take the money and kill it.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I just can't do it. You know, I don't think we can do it as a restaurant, you know, where we enjoy the change and the kind of crazy hecticness too much, you know, and
I think once you
stop evolving, I don't know, there's a weird stagnant thing. And like, maybe that's why we're about to be 10 years old, because, you know, the people that do come here know that they can continue to come and it's still going to be better than the last time. And I think I can wholeheartedly say that we are a better restaurant right now than when Sam Sifton wrote that review in 2010.
Mm-hmm.
Like, hands down, bar none, without a doubt. And we're only going to continue to get better.
Well, I mean, I'm sure you'll take this as the compliment. It's a compliment, right? Because I had been in here years ago, and then I came in here about 2 weeks ago, and, you know, it was that moment where I had this regret that I hadn't been here in between. You know, like, I was like, what did I miss?
Mm-hmm.
You know, how many great dinners did I miss?
And that kind of goes back to what I was saying before, where I think maybe because we didn't hit that stride in the first 6 months, you know, we have this joke sometimes where, like, I almost want to write letters to people that I want to come in here that haven't eaten here yet come in and eat.
Yeah.
But then I feel like that seems like a little, I don't know.
Pushy?
Yeah, I don't know. Whatever. And, like, at the end of the day, like, what am I trying to achieve out of that?
Well, if it would be meaningful to you, are these chefs, yeah, writers, industry
people, you know, it's just like, I'm so proud of what we do here.
Yeah.
And I started this with saying, like, I don't think we're necessarily on, you know, people know who we are. I'm like, trust me, I'm not.
Yeah,
we are very
yeah.
blessed.
Yeah.
We are busy.
Yeah.
You know, I just don't know if everybody understands the quality, the ingredients, the technique, like how, like I said, most people don't look at this place as a quote unquote tasting menu restaurant.
Yeah.
We probably do anywhere between 12 to 18 tasting menus a night.
Mm-hmm.
You know, out of 100 covers, that's a lot.
That's a lot. Yeah.
You know, and those are 7, 8, 9 course tasting menus. You know
right.
what I mean? So I think, like I said, sometimes it gets a little convoluted between Larry's son and is he a celebrity chef, which I hate. You know, with the TV thing, and, you know, it's like, and you can ask anybody. I think the thing that surprises most people is that I'm actually here.
Probably.
Which drives me nuts. There's nothing I hate more than when somebody says,
mentioned my book.
Why are you here?
You mentioned my book a few times, you know, and I would interview people for the book, and people said to me, you know, so the book ends in the early 90s, and people would say, that time you're writing about was so great. You'd go to a restaurant and the chefs were there. Right? And that is true. Like, I was just starting to be around the business then. Now it is very much almost like it's almost like a special treat when you go somewhere and someone's, I don't
mean
you.
Crazy.
But,
that's crazy.
But it is. I mean, people might have a dozen restaurants. They might have restaurants in 3 different states.
Yeah,
you know.
The way that I look at that, because, you know, I have multiple restaurants.
Yeah.
I try to do, you know, my restaurants are in New York, so it makes it easier
for me. They're
also
not that far from each other.
Right, so it makes it a little easier for me, but I try to do one day in Cut Tribeca, you know, one day in Cut Midtown, and then the rest of the days I spend here, you know?
Yeah.
And, you know, don't get me wrong, I'm not in here at 9 o'clock in the morning, you know, peeling asparagus or anything, but, you know, I work the pass, I talk to the guests, we confer on dishes, I speak to my chefs every day, and, and that's only, and I my response is always this: I'm not here because I need to be.
Yeah.
It's because I want to be.
Mm-hmm.
When I stop wanting to be, I guess I'll stop coming in. I don't know.
Yeah. So you mentioned a couple of things in the last minute or two. First of all, you mentioned the television thing. I mean, it seems to me that these days, with the amount of competition, especially a place like New York, I mean, you mentioned how many people you know who've gone out of business, and I do too, and I'm sure some of these are mutual friends. Someone recently asked me if I thought what I thought about the whole quote-unquote celebrity thing or whatever you want to call it. And I said, you know, to my mind, a chef who has the opportunity to be famous and isn't, it's almost fiscally irresponsible to me today.
Yeah. Well, today. You just said it, especially in New York.
I mean, how else do you stay in public eye? You know, once you go through an opening, you get reviewed and all that stuff, like something's got to keep you front of mind for people. Yeah. And it seems to me like that's one of the things that does it. And it's a fine line.
Well, you know what it is, though, in New York, too, though? And I think any New Yorker will back me up on this. They might come in once because you're on TV.
Mm-hmm.
But a New Yorker is savvy enough.
Oh, sure.
Where if that meal isn't good.
Totally.
They are not coming back just because you're on TV. And that's what I tell people all the time. Because, you know, the young guys, I want to be on TV. I want to do this. And it's like, listen, man, it's not about being on TV.
Yeah.
Like, if you get the opportunity, I agree with you. Go for it. But that is not going to solve everything.
No.
It will get them in there once.
Yeah.
But you better make sure that when they get in there, they come back because they had an amazing meal, not because they got your autograph.
I mean, I'll go one better. I don't know how many New Yorkers will even go to a restaurant because someone's on television, but I do think it's this constant reminder.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, restaurants don't advertise on television,
yeah,
but if you're on a show, you're constantly in front of people.
Yeah.
And the rate at which restaurants open these today, it's just, people don't have the bandwidth. They don't have the loyalty they used to have. This is another thing I hear from people who were around decades ago. There just weren't that many restaurants.
Yep.
You know?
And you know what else,
I hear
too?
It all, yeah.
I mean, I feel like I need to say this, is what's happening with rent now.
Yeah.
And it's really, I think, a really scary time in our business.
Yes.
The days of like a young unsung kid sitting on a porch and promising that he'll give a guy $350,000 are so few and far between now, because you have to remember, when I was doing that, we were signing a deal for $16,000 a month. My rent is now $34,500.
In a decade.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, you know, now I look at spaces almost for fun.
Yeah.
And I hate to say for fun, that's not what I mean. Like, just to see, you know, what's out there. I looked at a space half the size of this.
Mm.
The kitchen was the size of my bathroom. And they were asking $24.50 a month.
Mm.
So how is a young kid who's maybe not on TV,
Or
doesn't have or doesn't have a name, just wants to be a chef.
Yes. Like,
that's what I wanted to do when I was sitting out on my deck.
Yeah.
How does that kid turn that into a $4.5 million restaurant when he's competing with all the other things? And I think that's why now you see, you know, people like myself or the Terese guys or, you know, the Danielle Belouds of the world or the, you know, the Jean Georges, you know, it's like, it's all, you know, the Laurent Tourandels, there's multiple restaurants now with the big names, you know, the Michael Whites and, you know, forgive me for anybody else I'm forgetting here. So it's like tough for the next generation to break in. You know what I mean? And I feel so bad for the younger kids coming up right now, because, you know, I don't even know. I don't know if I could name five new people in the last 5 years that are coming up. Like, who is it? You know, it's like...
Yeah. I mean, it's like Fabian and Jeremiah Wild Air and... No,
it's a scary
Greg
time.
Greg Backstrom at
Olmstead is a great
through.
Example.
Yeah.
I hope, you know what I mean.
Yeah.
Where is Olmstead though?
In Brooklyn,
you know, and it's like,
well, look, I've been saying this. You know, I've been out on the road, so I've been, you know, every talk has like a Q&A portion, so I've been asked a lot about the kind of stuff we're talking about right now, right? And I had this epiphany recently, which is, you know, there's all these. It's not a supply and demand thing, right? Why are there so many restaurants? Because there's so many people who want to be in the restaurant business, right? I mean, there's people who want to be chefs. I think more than ever, there's people who want to be, you know, sommeliers. They want to be general managers. They want to be running a dining room, right? But that's not supply and demand. That's these are people who have dreams.
Yep.
And I think this is why, you know, look at somebody like Gavin Kazin, who left New York and went home to Minneapolis and is thriving.
Yep.
I think, you know, he did that by choice very much. He was part of the Daniel Boulud empire that you're talking about, but he made that decision. But I do think that's going to be part of the answer for people is going elsewhere.
Yeah.
You may not be able to have that in LA, New York, San Francisco, Chicago.
Well, that's another great
thing. You may
thing.
Not, it's but a- that's okay because also this sounds corny and tacky, but, you know, and sentimental, but there'll be more good restaurants in more places. And these people, I mean, not everyone has to have the Manhattan restaurant.
I agree.
And they can't, and they won't. And that's also why so many places close.
Yeah, it's just a different era. Yeah. I just feel bad. I feel like...
You feel like you just got in under the wire?
Like literally.
Yeah.
Like it was, you know what I mean? Like the door just shut and I just got
Indiana
in.
Jones.
Yeah,
right.
Exactly. Yeah. And like, you know, I just, you know, I you know as well as I do, I think, and I think it's great that a kid from, for example, I don't know, Kansas City is going to say, you know what, I'll go train in New York and then go back to Kansas City. I think it's amazing. I truly do.
Yeah.
I just... You know, I just think that, you know, for, you know, there was always like 5 years of like a new rush of, you know, who's the new up and coming star in New York. And like, it's, you know, when you're given these tiny spaces with these ridiculous rents and what payroll is now and all this stuff, if you don't have a corporate backing, I don't see how it's possible. It's like to have a mom and pop, like, and it's,
no,
it's just sad. And like, and I think the mom and pops, you know, I have 2.5 years left on this lease.
Mm-hmm.
What if he tells me it's 45?
Right.
What am I supposed to do?
Yeah. Right.
Where do I go?
Like, yeah.
And it's just sad. Sad.
It is.
I don't know how there's like the can't make a law. Like, I don't know, like some type of like cap or something. Like, yeah. I don't know.
No, it's, I don't know. I mean, it is amazing how many people are in this business just for the love of it. You know, who the love of it, incompatibility with anything else.
You have to.
I mean, but that's what it takes. I mean, I was a theater kid growing up, and the way, you know, young cooks remind me of people I knew who wanted to be actors, mm-hmm. you know, who that's all they want to do. That's their dream. And they're going to do whatever it takes to have it, you know? And I think it's very compatible.
Yeah.
So before we stop, tell me American Cut. How did that come about?
I mean, I think it was inevitable with my BLT training that I wasn't going to open a steakhouse at some point.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think we all know, you know, steakhouses are a much different run than a, we'll use the word fine dining.
Yeah.
You know, I met the guys from LDV, John Meadow, Ricky Weisfish, and we were opening Revel. You remember Revel?
Yeah.
Which we're reopening, by the way.
Is that right?
But it's as Ocean's Resort.
Okay.
June 28th.
Okay.
I was put together. It was kind of like one of those kind of, this guy needed a thing, this guy needed a thing. And like, hey, well, why don't you guys meet? And they came here and I said, you know, instead of me like talking about who I am, like, why don't you guys just come back in, you know, next Friday. I'll sit you at the big table over there and I'll pretend we're at a steakhouse and I'll make you a meal.
Perfect.
And that was it. I mean, halfway through
this is like you were back to doing the dinners.
Halfway through the second course, you know, I think John got up off the table and said, let's do this.
Yeah.
You know, we opened Revel, we killed it. It was a lot of fun while it lasted.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that was like rock and roll, man. I mean, we were 2 weeks into it. We did 600 covers on a Friday.
Oh my God.
And then I had the opportunity to do, you know, it's funny. People are like, why do you keep doing Tribeca? And like, kind of back to what we said before, I don't plan anything.
Yeah.
You know, there's a funny saying, you know, you want to hear God laugh, just tell him your plans.
Yeah, right.
But anyway, so I swear to you, I was eating dinner at that Italian restaurant, whatever it was called, the Cinque Terre, I think, which is now American Cut, Tribeca. And I was with my now wife and I just remember eating and it was fine, whatever, but it was empty. And I was like, God, this is such a cool space. Like it had like bricks and like arch things.
Yeah.
And 3 weeks later, John's like, hey, there's a space in Tribeca that is up. And I was like, okay. And I looked at the address. I was like, cool. I'll meet you there. As I'm walking up, I'm like, come on.
That's hilarious.
We opened up Cut Tribeca. It's been great. you know, people seem to love it.
Yeah, it's great.
I tell people all the time, we're not trying to be Smith and Walensky or Peter Luger's or Keane's.
No, it's its own animal.
Yeah. I love those restaurants, but we're not. We're you know, a little more, you know, I don't know, unbuttoned and fun and rock and roll. And
well, and it's also not trying to be kind of like fake historical. Like it feels like something that was built when it was built.
Yeah. I mean, that's what it is. I mean, that's the, you know, the, I hate using the word modern steakhouse, but you know, it's,
it doesn't feel themey. Yeah. But it doesn't feel themey. What?
And then Keo too. It can't be, I can't,
oh, I love can't not that talk restaurant. About Keo.
Yeah. That's, you know, I try to explain to people, I'm a partner in the restaurant, but it is all Chef Pet, Sula Fetchwader.
Explain how that restaurant came about.
Yeah, he's one of my best friends.
Yeah.
We were roommates at one point.
Yeah.
Him and I have been working together since BLT.
Yeah.
Since AZ, actually.
Okay.
And, you know, he was, you know, helped me open here. Sous chef, you know, he did his own thing. And, you know, kept, you know, came back and he helped me open Atlantic City. And, you know, I just told him, dude, look, like your food is some of the best food I've ever tasted in my life. Whether I'm in a restaurant or not, like he used to make a staff meal.
I mean,
you know, he would cook me dinner when we lived together. Like it's just so good. And I said, whenever you're ready, just tell me. And he basically said, okay, I'm ready.
Yeah.
And again, Tribeca came calling and it was a place called Duane Park Cafe and they were closing and
amazing.
It was like, all right, let's do this.
Yeah, and I have to tell people it's K-H-E. K-H-E-Y-O. Yeah, Keo. It is awesome. It's a small restaurant. You know who took me there the first time I ever ate there? Paul Liebrandt.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Yeah.
We had it's awesome. Yeah. I always forget that you're part of that.
Yeah.
But
again, there's no credit for any of the food. It's all
But you help make that a reality.
Yes. Yeah. I connected the dots for him. And
can you just quickly, before we wrap up, because you've alluded to it a few times, I don't think civilians understand this. How often a restaurant comes about because of the real estate piece?
Yeah. I mean,
in other words, a restaurateur or a chef restaurateur may hear about it's the space, the deal, the terms, the timing. People will create a concept, will they not?
Well, I told you before.
To take advantage of a good real estate deal.
Yeah, I told you before. Like, you know, all the chefs are on this email thread from real estate brokers.
Yes.
But every once in a while, one comes up, and I'm like, oh, you know what? I actually really love that restaurant.
Yeah.
I'm going to go look at it.
Yeah.
You know, but again, sad to say, usually they're way too expensive these days.
Sure.
But yeah, sometimes you walk into the space. You know, I used to love going to Duane Park Cafe. Mm-hmm. I used to love it.
Mm-hmm.
It was a cool late night jazz thing, and I used to love it. And like I said, I was sitting at Cinque Terre, and boom, I was like, wow, this is such an amazing restaurant. So yeah, I mean, real estate has almost everything to do with it.
Yeah.
It goes back to way before when we said, when I walked in this space, it was literally like this voice of energy that just kind of enveloped me that said, this is home, this is it.
Yeah, great. Okay, well, on that note, it was great talking to you. This is the first real conversation probably we've had.
Yeah, since the bar at BLT Fish.
Yes. All right. Well, listen, happy impending 10th anniversary.
Thank you.
And I hope you guys are here for a long time.
Thanks, brother.
Okay. And that's our show. Thank you to Mark Forgione for sitting down for the interview. Caitlin, thank you for joining me. You didn't get to say much this week.
That's fine because as you can tell, I'm really tired.
Well, it helps, as always, it helps me to have you here. David Tatasciore, thanks for splicing this thing together. As always, our engineer, David, thank you. And thanks to all of you out there in podcast land for listening to the show. We're almost caught up on our backlog, so I don't know if you'll get another show before next week. But there is some special stuff coming up soon. I'm finally getting around to doing my special report with Allison Robicelli that we've been talking about for a while on the topic of harassment and abuse in the restaurant industry. And there's something else new coming up, a new recurring feature of the show that I'm not going to say anything yet. I want to make sure it's going to be locked and loaded, but that'll be in early July. So some cool stuff on the horizon. And that's it, everybody. We'll see you soon.